From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made right at the beginning of spring when one of the really pivotal New York State Senate races really took shape. Longtime broadcaster Rich Funke entered the race as a Republican challenging the incumbent, a Democrat, Ted O'Brien. And since then, we have seen the race certainly pick up, especially this week. And let me also make sure that our listeners understand, not only you're going to see the debate tonight on WXXI TV, WXXI Radio, streaming on WXXI.org, but also we've invited candidates for prominent offices throughout the year in this election year to come into this program. And we've been hoping to have Rich Funke. We still do. Rich is running for state senate against Ted O'Brien. We've certainly been working on finding time that would be convenient for him. Haven't been able to do that yet, but we do hope that happens eventually. We do have Senator Ted O'Brien in studio with us right now. And first I'll say, Senator O'Brien, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you finally did have a debate alongside Rich Funke this week, and it was it more heated than you expected?
Well, I think that, you know, this has been the first opportunity where we both have been at this same community forum to talk about the issues. And I think because there's been a frustration by a whole series of community groups who've offered community forums, in which I've participated in six of them that have been where invitations have been extended, I think because he's refused to participate in public forums, that this one had an added importance. This is one of the few opportunities for people to hear both my issues and as opposed to his in the same room. And so I think that heightened the importance of yesterday's event, given that people don't know much about Rich Funke other than his media personality. They don't know where he stands on the issues, and he's never had to take a vote in his life. So for him not to be in programs like yours, Evan, I know he's saying he has scheduling conflicts, but you know, you have to find time to be able to engage with the public. People have a right to understand where you stand on the issues that are important to them.
Well, we do hope that Rich will find time, and I know it's been a busy campaign. It is an open invitation to him and his office. Let's listen to just a few of those clips from the debate, and Senator O'Brien, remind our listeners where the debate took place.
Right. This was down at the Rochester Riverside Convention Center. It was with the sponsored by the Rochester Rotary.
Okay. And so the first clip, I'm just going to play. Well, let's go with three clips here, David. The first one is things got a little bit heated at times. Here's an example from the debate of that.
I don't know which three positions you're talking about here, Ted.
I can tell you if you'd like. First, you were for a ban.
I have the floor now. Thank you.
I'll tell you what they are if you want.
Okay, I think you were talking about fracking at that point, and we're going to get to that. But Mr. Funke also talked about why he's running and why he thinks he's got the right perspective. This is the second clip, Dave. Let's listen.
Because after 40 years of press releases crossing my desk, I think I know BS when I see it, when I hear it, and there's plenty of it in Albany.
And Rich Funke also talked about You see a lot of talk in this campaign about New York City politicians, and he also in the debate yesterday with Senator O'Brien invoked that notion as well. Let's listen.
New York City politicians don't know their way out of the Bronx, and you voted with them 97% of the time.
So did Joe Robach.
That's your voting record.
It's the same. You're twisting the facts.
You're supported by the Working Families Party, which is on record as opposing the 2% tax cap.
New York City politicians. All right, Senator O'Brien, you said right there, so did Joe Robach. How is he twisting the facts?
Well, the fact of the matter is we have hundreds and hundreds of bills every year, and most of them are not controversial. Most of them are supported by both sides of the aisle. But you're able to pull out, if you're sneaky, you pull out facts that try to create an argument that doesn't exist. The fact of the matter is, whether you're a downstate or upstate, every senator gets one vote, and you vote consistent with the interests of your district if you're being a good representative, and that's what I've done. So this notion that somehow I only vote with New York City, no, not any more than any other senator does. Most of the things we act on are passed by both sides of the aisle.
I happen to live in your Senate district, and I've brought some of the mailings, and I will tell you that I've seen quite enough of them. I know you're also here to tell me that voters probably should understand that some of it's not coming from you and some of it is not coming from Rich Funke. But every day there seems to be a big glossy mailer. Here's Ted O'Brien looking like he's going to burn down a city. Here's Rich Funke looking like he's trying to hide and scare people. You know, here's Ted O'Brien looking like a marionette. Every single day I see this, and one of them Senator O'Brien, a mailing from the Republicans, or actually I don't know offhand who it came from, and you're probably going to tell me that that's part of the point. But anyway, it says that Ted O'Brien wants to create a New York City-style campaign finance system for the whole state, which could cost taxpayers over $100 million to subsidize campaigns like his. I'm not sure that's incorrect, is it?
I do think that we want to take steps to try to get the corrupting influence of money out of Albany. And one way you do that is with public financing. I do think that that it's difficult to do in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court case that allows corporations to spend money almost uninhibited. But I do think we can take steps to try to get the influence of money out. And one of the things that you've suggested, Evan, is that, you know, the mailboxes are full. And of course, campaigns like to target messages to just voters in their district as a way to conserve resources. But I think what a lot of people don't understand is something you touched on. And that is that some people get two different mailings from my opponent or two different mailings from me, even on the same day. And that is because other groups that are allied with us or are supportive of us but cannot coordinate with us have their own thoughts, and they send mailings out. Sometimes they arrive in the same day that maybe our campaign has sent out a mailing. And I think the end result is a lot of mail. But I hope people will read it and get a sense of where each candidate stands.
Let me read what it says in the corner of one of these mailings where they're attacking your plan. It says, paid for by Balance NY, an independent expenditure committee. This communication was not expressly authorized or requested by any candidate or by any candidate's political committees or any of its agents. So there's one. I'm trying to look at some of the others here. The other comes from a state Democratic committee. Okay, there's one. So every one of these has a sort of a different place that they came from.
Right.
And in your view, is that part of the problem?
Well, I do think we could do better. You mentioned that at Balanced New York. That's largely run by hedge fund managers whose big issue is supporting primarily New York City charter schools, and they're supporting my opponent. But what's really important is that we really need to understand who is funding these campaigns. And it's been very, very difficult, both this year and maybe even more so 2 years ago. I was targeted with some really vicious negative mail. And the Attorney General, even with subpoena power, couldn't in some instances figure out who was behind the mailings. And I think people need to understand who's funding my race, who's funding my opponent's race, and what those interests are that are being advanced.
So when it comes to campaign finance reform, they invoked New York City. They've got, a 6-to-1 matching? I'm in New York City. Should there be, for example, a 6-to-1 public match the way we've seen in some other municipalities and government systems?
You know, I think the New York City model has been met with some positives and also some negatives. But what I do believe is that there has to be really increased transparency in and accountability for who is paying for the funding of campaigns. And I think if we can get through that, I know our Attorney General has worked very hard on trying to add transparency to the political process. And that's certainly a step that would be helpful.
But the governor is someone you're supporting, and by just about every account this year, contrary to what he claims, he has not been very supportive of campaign finance reform. He did not lay it all on the line for it the way others expected him to do it this year.
Well, and I think as legislators, we have a special responsibility as being our own branch of government to advance the cause. And I do think we have a number of different people who are trying to work in a positive way, myself included, and that would be, again, to increase disclosure of who is funding political campaigns and what their agendas are, because sometimes that's as significant as what's actually said in the mailer.
All right, so no dark money, disclosure, transparency, but a public match, yes or no?
I'm not quite there as far as a public match goes, and I would be, except that if we're not going to be able to get the corrupting influence of money out of politics because of the Citizens United case, I'm not sure it's the wisest expenditure of money. If we can overturn Citizens United or actually impose a ban on how much money can be spent by corporate interests, then I think we can go the next step to public financing. But we have a first step to get to first.
Okay. We're talking to Senator Ted O'Brien. If you want to join the conversation, you can do that. He is running for re-election. His opponent, Rich Funke, appeared next to him in a debate yesterday, but we haven't been able to find time yet to get Rich Funke on this program. We hope that will change soon, and we're certainly committed to doing that. And I know that that's an important part for our listening audience, and it's important to me as the host of this program as well. Let's talk about the Women's Equality Agenda. It's mm-hmm. come up many times, and I want to hit a number of points within the one point that's the hinge point. The Women's Equality Agenda is 10 points, but just about everyone agrees on 9 of the points. The 10th is about abortion, and that is really where the debate is. So, a few points here. First of all, the rate of abortion in New York State and the country is going down. We also know that New York State performs more abortions than any other state. So the practice is not in danger in this state as it stands. Last year, 23 states passed restrictions on abortion. Do you believe that New York State could narrow abortion access without this 10th point, this codification of Roe v. Wade that we're talking about?
Well, if, you know, the Supreme Court has begun to make some noises, like in the Hobby Lobby decision and others, that ultimately they may turn the decision about reproductive choice over to the states. If that happens, New York State's current law that's on the books predates Roe v. Wade. And so what we wouldn't have, if all of a sudden the federal protections of Roe v. Wade were removed and it left up to the states, we would not have the protections that flow from Roe v. Wade that talk about a licensed physician making a determination as to whether a woman's life or health is threatened. That's the language that flows from Roe v. Wade. And I think personally, and as the father of two young daughters, it's very important to provide protections that women have in New York right now. And so that if there is left to the states, there's not a time when women don't have rights that they currently have right now in New York
State. But is that realistic right now? I mean, right now the practice of abortion is not under threat in this state. And I'm trying to understand the scenario in which you think that could change.
Well, it only takes a vote of the Supreme Court to say, look, we're going to leave this up to the states.
But who in the state would change it?
No. What would happen then is that the existing statute that's on the books in New York State would now become the relevant statute. But
gotcha,
that was
okay.
passed 3 years before the Roe v. Wade decision,
yeah.
1970, and it doesn't include the life and health as determined by a licensed physician language that flows from the Roe v. Wade decision.
Okay, so almost 2 years after the Women's Equality Agenda has been rolled out now,
mm-hmm.
we've seen nothing passed, no real progress. So why not continue the debate about abortion that's going to happen and pass the other 9?
And that's happened in the Senate. I think there's been some misinformation about that as well. Last year, all 9 of the first points of the Women's Equality Agenda came to the Senate as separate bills. All 9 I supported, all 9 passed. And then again this year, all 9 came to the Senate floor, all 9 were passed. As senators, all we can do is try to mirror what's happened in the assembly. That's to get a bill to the governor to sign. And unfortunately, there's been a resistance in the Senate to pass the same bill that was passed in the assembly. What we can commit to as senators is trying to do that. And I've said, let's not be hung up on a bill, this 10th point, that is not an expansion. In fact, I brought it with you. I can read the 2 substantive sentences that it is. And it really is just 2 sentences. The first one says the law of the land will be as established by Roe v. Wade. And the second sentence is this important element I was just talking about, that a woman can make her own reproductive choice up to the 24th week, or if her life or health is threatened as determined by a licensed physician. That's the 10th point in its totality. And to hold up those other 9 points by insisting on taking away rights that women have in New York right now, to me, is unconscionable.
Okay, a couple more points on this, because this is a point of a lot of confusion. One thing we hear from opponents, including Rob Astorino, for example, is that this 10th point about abortion would allow non-doctors to perform abortion. Now, I have done my very best to sort through not only the language of the bill, but I have talked to doctors, legal experts, etc. And as a point of fact, the best I could tell is that that is wrong. Back in 1994, the state health department decided that physicians' assistants could perform abortions if they were trained and supervised by doctors. So that's going back 20 years. Now, I talked to Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. They tell me that surgical abortions are only performed by doctors in this district of Planned Parenthood. That's their choice. Could Could physician's assistants do it if they were trained and supervised? Yes, Planned Parenthood says it's not happening anyway. But the bottom line is, this part of the law would not change who can provide abortions.
That's exactly right, Evan. It does not change. And in fact, I've got it in front of me, so I might as well read it. It says, this state shall not deny a woman's right as established by the United States Supreme Court in the decision Roe v. Wade. That's the first sentence. It says, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, New York protects a woman's rights to terminate a pregnancy within 24 weeks from commencement of her pregnancy or when necessary to protect a woman's life or health as determined by a licensed physician. Those are the substantive provisions in the act. I wish Rich Funke would read it and try to explain to me how that authorizes non-licensed physicians to perform abortions or late-term abortions. I guess if a doctor determines that a woman's life isn't threatened, that isn't it reasonable to expect that a doctor should be able to do that, perform a life-saving measure? I think so.
All right, a couple more points on this. First of all, another question we've gotten. The bill would not prevent doctors from declining to offer abortions based on religious or moral grounds. That wouldn't change. Partial birth abortion ban would not change. The only question that I guess I have, Senator O'Brien, is whether the law would expand abortion availability based on, and let me read again the language from, I pulled it from the Assembly. I assume it's the same, but here's what it says. This part would allow a woman to terminate her pregnancy within 24 weeks of the commencement of her pregnancy or, when necessary, to protect a woman's life or health as determined by a licensed physician. Does this mean that post 24 weeks, more women would be allowed to terminate pregnancies if they and their doctor decided that mentally it would be a challenge, that they aren't comfortable? I'm not talking about a life-threatening issue. I'm talking about mental health. Would that expand more availability later on?
It wouldn't expand it because this is the current state of the law now. That language about when necessary to protect a woman's life or health is determined by a licensed physician, that is the current law, the federal law, that needs to be protected in New York in case the Supreme Court wants to overturn it. That is the current state of the law. So whatever is the current status, this is really just a codification in New York state law of what the current federal law is. These are rights that women have in New York now. No change.
Okay. And also, important to point out that the vast majority of abortions do happen before 24 weeks, and that in this case here, there are more protections for doctors, I think, based on this. Is that also true, Senator O'Brien?
Well, the one thing in the kind of the enabling language of the bill, it talks about if somebody is acting consistent with the provisions of this act, being the one we're talking about, that doctors wouldn't be prosecuted under the criminal code. This language would be incorporated in the civil code, the health law. And that, like every other surgical procedure and every other health procedure that we have. And that's only, I mean, if there's criminal actions done, they will still be criminal. And like you say, there's a specific reference. We're not talking about partial birth abortion or anything like that.
Right.
Banned in all 50 states, continues to be banned in all states. This simply is not an expansion of abortion rights. It's protecting women with rights that they currently have in New York.
Now, let me try to understand where Rich Funke would be coming from, because, again, I hope that we can talk to him. But he supports the other 9 points in the bill. The mailings have attacked him as being anti-woman, against the women's equality agenda. And he's saying, look, we agree on those other 9 points, and that is unfair to attack him for that on the other 9 points. Is it unfair, Senator O'Brien?
Well, I don't think so. And I wish he was here to speak for himself. I really do. And I think he owes the community that. But unfortunately, he continues to refuse to enter into debates like this and forums like this. But the fact of the matter is, senators, if we wanted to pass the first 9 points, we have to replicate what was done in the Assembly. Our option is to replicate what was done in the Assembly. That's what we could do to implement them as state senators. And to say that you can't have these other 9 rights unless you give up your reproductive right that you currently have now, to me, is beyond the pale. And I think he needs to be held accountable for that stance.
And so, therefore, you think that qualifies as saying he's against the entire agenda, that he's against.
He thinks
women's
it's
rights.
More important to take away rights that women have now than it is giving them the first 9 points.
And we're going to get to the phones in a minute. I just want to hit a couple more points with Senator Ted O'Brien, who's in studio with us for the hour, running for re-election. You talked about fracking yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there has been a lot of entanglements about that in the campaign. First of all, your own position. Let's go ahead and circle back to that if people have missed it. Where do you stand on fracking and frack waste?
Well, you know, I during this last session became the ranking member on the Environmental Conservation Committee. And because this is particularly important to me, one of the very first things I did was have public forums on fracking. And one of the issues that came to my attention by scientists and people interested in this area was that even though we don't allow high-volume horizontal hydrofracking in New York right now, they do in Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania has a problem of disposing its waste. They don't allow it to be accepted in, for example, the wastewater treatment facilities. Do you know that, and I think people were shocked to recognize that we were taking the garbage or the waste from hydrofracking operations in New York landfills. They had to close a wastewater treatment plant in Auburn from fracking wastewater, not necessarily because it was toxic, although we don't know what's in the fracking waste, but because of the briny, salty nature killed the biologics. And what I learned was that in New York State, we only have one wastewater treatment facility that's a chemical treatment facility rather than a biologic. And a couple of concerns I have. As you know, Evan, the state has undertaken a long study conducted jointly by the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Health. And ultimately, there'll be some consensus. But if the consensus becomes that fracking can be done safely if you do this, this, and this, I still have grave concerns because, first of all, what are we going to do about the fracking waste and that's now being deposited in our landfills, for example, and what are we going to do about the wastewater, which is I think in some respects, the waste issues are even bigger than the fracking operation wastes. So I think we need to answer that question. And beyond that, if companies were to do X, Y, and Z, it could be done safely. Do we have the resources? Are we willing to devote the resources to monitor an industry that probably shouldn't be self-regulated? It's too important because, keep in mind, in my view, our most precious resource that we have upstate and in Monroe and Ontario counties is our fresh water. And if we do anything to disrupt that, then we really are going to have significant issues for our ability to flourish as a region. And so for those reasons, I have real pause about hydrofracking, and we've got to answer all the questions.
We have a Voice of the Voter poll that we've helped put together that we're going to be releasing the results this weekend. And I've had a chance to see some of the results. I can't divulge them all, but I will tell you that it is no surprise that a large part of the voting population in the state now believes that Governor Cuomo has delayed making a decision based on politics and convenience. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not in his head, and I don't know. But I would hope, and we're only a couple of weeks away from elections, I think at some point in the relatively near future, we will have some reports from the Department of Health. And I look forward to reading those very carefully as well.
Scott Waldman for Capital NY wrote a report saying that the Cuomo administration worked with requested from USGS a report that the science wasn't changed, but the language of the conclusion was softened by the Cuomo administration. What did you make of that?
Well, I'm not sure if that's really a fair statement. I'd have to review the actual language that they use there. But I think the Cuomo administration is doing a careful analysis and will be guided by the science. And that's all we can ask of any department or state agency.
All right, let me get to the phones here. If you want to get to the phones here, by the way, I'm seeing that we're flying through the hour. You can call the program at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or toll-free, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's get to a very short break, and then we'll come back, take your calls, get your comments for Senator Ted O'Brien, who's running for re-election and joining us for the hour right here on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we talk to Sarah Weddington, one of the litigants in the Roe v. Wade case.
What's that?
She's coming to Western New York soon. She's going to talk about abortion access over the last 40 years. Then we'll talk to Planned Parenthood of Central and Western New York. They respond to their critics, who say that their provision of access to abortion targets minorities. They also tell us what they want to see change for women's health. That's Thursday.
On the next Fresh Air, the disappearing religions of the Middle East. People like the Yazidis, Coptic Christians, and Assyrians who have survived persecution over the centuries and are now threatened by ISIS, other Islamists, or civil war. These are ancient religions that offer clues about ancient times. We talk with Gerard Russell, author of Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms. Join us.
Tonight at 7.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections, and I briefly welcome back our news director, Randy Gorman from WXXI News.
Thanks, Evan. And just to remind everybody, this is the week we try to do this as little as we can during the year, so as not to have to preempt any of your programming. So we'll make some brief mentions, but this is the week we need your support. Of course, we are partly community funded, and a big part is the folks who listen to programs like this. Very thoughtful discussions about the topics, elections, of course, on a lot of people's minds for the next couple of weeks as we head up to the November 4th Election Day. And tonight here on WXXI, we will be simulcasting that debate out in Buffalo, probably the only time all the gubernatorial candidates will debate. And you'll hear our own Karen DeWitt, Albany Capital correspondent, who Evan, I know, has been on your show a number of times. She'll be among those asking the questions. We'll bring that to you right here on WXXI AM 1370, also at WEOS and WXXI TV, and online streaming at WXXINews.org. And again, all this costs money, and we need your support. It doesn't have to be a lot, but whatever you can afford, you can do that right now by going to our website, WXXI.org. You don't even have to use Apple Pay. You can just do this the old-fashioned way. You can just get out the credit cards, and it is a secure site. It's the the HTTPS website, yeah, which is a secure way of making your payment. But we do need your support, no matter what you can afford to do. It does help. It all adds up. And we have an ambitious goal this week. I think it's, $300,000. And I know we need a little help to get there. So please go there right now to WXXI.org and do what you can.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Randy Gorman, news director of WXXI News. Let's get to the phones with Senator Ted O'Brien. This is Patricia in Irondequoy. Patricia, thanks for calling Connections.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Senator O'Brien, I've been listening to this interview with Ethan, and I just felt moved to call in to tell you that I appreciate your honesty, your thoughtfulness, and your integrity around sharing your opinions about some of these really important issues that face upstate New York. And I'm really concerned that Rich Funke just continues to obfuscate and avoid trying to have these difficult discussions, because they are difficult and controversial. So I just wanted to let you know that I personally admire your integrity and your willingness to work for the citizens of upstate New York. And I'll take your comments offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia, very much for your call. I do feel that, particularly at this time of year, that we have an obligation to engage with those people that we represent and in as many different forums as we can. I think that leads to better government and better democracy, and I really appreciate your kind comments.
I will also say that Mr. Funke has told us, his campaign has told us, that he's out door-to-door every day and that it's been hard to find time to come in here. But he's been actively trying to talk to voters in different sort of forums and scenarios. So, and again, that certainly, we're all busy and we all have to make decisions on scheduling. Now, when it comes to Rich Funke, in a recent Siena poll, a couple weeks old now, Ted, had you 25 points down. We're reminded that Mayor Tom Richards of Rochester was given a huge lead by Siena and lost big to Lovely Warren. First of all, if you beat Rich Funke, does that invalidate Siena forever? I mean, I know the folks are very nice folks there, but are you aiming to invalidate their polling?
Well, I do think that there's a couple of problems both with their methodology, which has people self-identify where they're likely to vote, and there's some problems with their polling mechanisms. But a couple of other things. I don't know all about their methodology, but you're right. I mean, 3 days before Lovely Warren won by 17 points, Siena said that she was down by 36, and that's a huge, huge swing. And the other thing is that the Siena poll was, their pollsters were surveying long before our campaign really started. And I think, Mr. Funke got the benefit of having been a media personality for a lot of years, and people knew the name and so on, but hadn't really known who we would be as far as a Senate candidate goes. So I think the poll was early, the methodology probably flawed, and certainly they've made big misses here in our region before. So we don't pay any attention to it. We believe we're doing fine and that we'll be successful on Election Day. But it is important for everybody to come out and vote.
Joe Spector wrote a piece, a reporter Joe Spector wrote a piece last week about corporate welfare, that New York leading the country by a wide margin in corporate welfare in terms of tax breaks, cuts, and handouts to corporations. And David K. Johnston is just one example of reporters who've reported on this issue over the years. And they tell you that there is a real imbalance in the favor of corporations, in the favor of big business, and that Joe Spector's report confirms that, and the state needs to make changes. Now, you're a state senator. Do you agree with that, first of all?
I do agree, and I think that, you know, one of the things that makes people most upset when they see their public money going, particularly like for promised job creation programs that don't end up creating the promised jobs, and that corporate interests get the benefit of public money and never have to pay the consequences. And that's why I've introduced something called the New York Jobs Protection Act. And what it does is it says that if you are receiving public monies because of a commitment to create jobs, and at any time after you receive that public money, your employment in New York drops from what it was at the beginning, not only do you pay the money back, which I think everybody would seeming is reasonable, but you pay it back with penalty. And the reason I say that is that I can envision corporate managers saying, look, let's take the public money. If we don't create the jobs, we'll give it back. And there's no incentive for them to actually keep and grow their jobs in New York. So that's the purpose for introducing this legislation. And it's one of my priorities for this next session is to getting it through. It's carried by Assemblyman Bronson in the Assembly. And I think it's just good, sane, smart legislation.
In some degree, are you concerned that the business community will view that as anti-business in any way?
Well, I've had very frank discussions with the Rochester Business Alliance and the business community here, and they understand that we don't necessarily have agreement on every issue. But I've got the support not only of the labor community here in Rochester, but also the business community, and the Rochester Business Alliance endorsed me. And I think the reason is that they, first of all, trust me, and they know that when I say something, I mean it. And they believe that I have a depth of knowledge on the issues that are important. And I believe that they also believe that I'm a tenacious fighter for our region in terms of resource allocation. And should the Senate go Democratic, as I believe it will, certainly, if not this year, certainly in 2016, there's just too many Senate districts that are predominantly Democratic now, it's going to happen, of how important it is to have a Democratic senator representing our region at the table when we're in the majority. And for all those reasons, the Business Alliance and the business community have embraced my candidacy.
All right, well then, why don't you frame for us exactly why this race should matter to people? When it comes to the control of the Senate, a lot of voters get cynical. We saw favorability ratings in our Voice of the Voter poll, again, that's going to be released Saturday night. They're not high for most people in elected office, and I know that that's sort of the historical trend. But why does this matter? Why does the who controls the Senate in this state matter?
Well, I think it's very important because as Democrats, we advance the interests of a whole range of people that maybe haven't had their interests represented as well as they could have. Women, for example, we should pass the Women's Equality Act, and when we come back in a majority, we will pass it. For low-wage earners and the minimum wage increase that we fought like dogs to try to get the minimum wage increase just a little bit last time, but there's room to have that grow so that the people that work a 40-hour work week can sustain themselves. That's what we ought to be moving towards, and with the Democratic majority, we will. With respect to maintaining reasonable restrictions on gun ownership, we have to recognize there's this very significant gun violence problem in this nation. And so for those reasons, it's not an upstate downstate divide. It's really an interest. The Democratic Party stands for working people, for single moms, for seniors on fixed incomes. Those are the things that are important to people, and on the bread and butter issues, the Democratic Party will do very well for the people of this district.
Why is the governor breaking his promise to the Working Families Party to campaign for Democrats for the state Senate?
Well, I don't know that he's breaking his promise. You know,
he hasn't been anywhere, has he?
He has. He's already started. He endorsed a Democratic state Senate downstate, and now some in the Hudson Valley. I don't anticipate what he will do. He may support me. He may not. But what's relevant to me is continuing to fight for the people of this district, irrespective of what the governor does or doesn't do. I think people have come to know that I'm an intelligent, hardworking legislator and will embrace my campaign irrespective of whether the governor endorses me or not.
We're talking to Senator Ted O'Brien running for re-election. And last hour we talked about ways that everyone, whether you're a parent in the Rochester City School District or not, can make a difference to help kids, help graduation rates, help the quality of education. And Eric O'Brien, who's a columnist for the Democrat and Chronicle, made, I think, an interesting point, which is that if you take working families in the city versus working families in the suburbs, and we don't want to overgeneralize, but you're more likely in the city to have a minimum wage job. And right now, minimum wage is not supporting someone raising a child or two or trying to get by in the city. Republicans, Brian Kolb in the Assembly and many others have said, look, the minimum wage is not supposed to be a living wage. Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate, wants $15 an hour, says it has to be a minimum wage, and it can't just be nickel and dime increments. You've supported more of the incremental changes, but where does it need to eventually arrive at for you to be satisfied?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, I've supported legislation that would let different areas of the state determine their own, set their own minimum wage, because I think, you know, the cost of living in New York City obviously is different than it is here. And, you know, I've been on the show with you before with Kent Gardner, an economist who's spoken a lot about minimum wage. And I do think that there is a point where the minimum wage increase still has a stimulative effect to the local economy. And we're talking about putting more money in the pockets of hardworking men and women who aren't depositing it in Swiss bank accounts. They're out spending on things that they desperately need, because you're right, the current minimum wage doesn't even give you enough money to sustain yourself, even when you work a 40-hour week. So these are folks that we're going to take a little bit of extra money each week and put it right back into the economy at a time when we still have weakness in the economy. We need to grow it. So this precise amount of minimum wage, what I've been advocating for is $10.10. And I think that's consistent with the governor's proposing. I think there's movement in that direction. And I do think that there's room for a minimum wage increase, even in our area, or particularly in our area. And locales should be free to establish what that rate should be.
Attach it to inflation?
I think so. I think it should be indexed, so we don't have to go through the same exercise every few years about whether we should, and have this big debate. Let's attach it to set a sensible level and let it grow with inflation.
Back to the phones, Kevin and Victor. Kevin, thanks for calling Connections. You're on with Senator Ted O'Brien.
Hi. I've seen a few of your TV ads against Funky, and they just seem really dirty. I mean, just really ugly, dirty, disingenuous. And to me, that reflects on you as a candidate and a person. I don't really know you. Listening to you right now, you seem like a sensible person, but it's just they're really awful. And the link to abortion, it's like Roe v. Wade is not going anywhere. And this idea that people have to try to use abortion to mobilize and motivate women is really, I think, a terrible strategy, because everything else kind of gets put to the side.
Kevin, let me let Ted respond. I mean, he's saying he doesn't like the ads. And I know you've heard it from plenty of people.
You know, I think you're talking about an ad that was done by a group that has an independent expenditure. And we can't legally coordinate with groups that do their own advertisings. That wasn't my campaign, but I don't want to duck from that, because I do think, you know, I'm the father of two young girls, and the ad that you're talking about takes what was said to be a joke. But I just think we've got to elevate ourselves as state senators above the kind of locker room mentality that thinks it's okay to make fun in a way that demeans women. And so I think it's really important. I want my daughters to grow up in a world where we're not demeaning women and think it's funny or okay to. If it was any other group other than women, there'd be outrage. And I think there's been some outrage about that statement was made in an attempt to, you know, raise money because it does demean women. But, you know, Rich Funky's own campaign now is running an ad that I find, and it's not an independent expenditure, it's his own ad, and he's, you know, saying that how outraged he is and how he feels attacked. I just think it's disgusting to use the victims of child abuse to score political points. He's got an ad up now that says, I've voted against protecting victims from child abuse. To me, I've worked very, very closely, particularly with Bavona here locally, totally supportive. I have young girls that are 10 and 11. To me, it's absolutely disgusting to use victims of child abuse to score political points, and that's something that Rich Funky should be accountable for.
Now, the ad that you're talking about regarding the joke, is that the Facebook comment that he had made? I'm trying to remember.
No, that was a comment that he made that was then reproduced as part of a reel of things at a roast or something like that, and it it talked about women in a very derogatory way, particularly the sex trade in Canada, which has been, honestly, Evan, has been a huge problem, where human trafficking, and that's preventing human trafficking is one of the 8 points of the, it's the 8th point of the 10-point Women's Equality Act. But we have a huge problem just down the road from here. Ontario province, the province of Ontario in Canada, the sex trade coming into and manipulating women who oftentimes don't have many choices in life and exploiting them to make light of that in a public forum.
You don't think he really means to belittle that, which is obviously very serious, do you?
I think that when you make a joke about prostitution from Canada, it is a very demeaning kind of humor. And maybe that's okay in some locker room settings, but I'm saying that as a state senator, you have an obligation to elevate above that kind of locker room mentality. And we have to, I would like to prepare us to be a country where we don't think it's funny to demean other groups. And that's very important for me as the father of 2 young children.
Before I get back to the phones, are there any ads, mailers, etc., that are not from you directly regarding Rich Funky that you would say, I'm not comfortable with, that should not have gone out?
I think that the issues that we're talking about are very important. These are issues that have been highlighted both by my campaign and by other groups in support of my campaign. And I think it's important for people to understand who their representatives are. And at this point, I think the women's issues are very, very important. I want people to understand how important it is to me as a father and husband that we don't allow for the continued degradation of women, and that we do support the Women's Equality Act and all 10 points. I don't think most people feel that they need to have Rich Funky standing between themselves and their doctor, and when he insists that they shouldn't have choices they have now, and that that is a condition for having the first 9 points of the Women's Equality Act. So I think they all kind of come together, and I think when people really understand, I trust myself to vote on women's rights issues much more than I trust Rich Funky on that, and a range of other issues like minimum wage, like gun violence. I think it comes down to a question of who do you trust to be casting those important votes for you in the state Senate.
All right, back to the phones. Pete, Rochester. Go ahead, Pete.
Good afternoon. Root of the problem, campaign financing. MoveToAmend.org is proposing a constitutional amendment that clearly states that money is not speech and corporations are not people. Will you introduce a bill into the Senate for a vote to state clearly that New York State is in agreement with money is not speech and corporations are not people?
I agree completely with that sentiment, and thanks for the call. The thing is that right now that is a determination that is made by the Supreme Court of the United States, so we'd either have to have a constitutional amendment federally or an overturning of that decision
and
at the
I'm
Supreme
asking
Court level.
You if you will propose that amendment, that bill in the Senate of New York State to clearly have a vote where the state representatives agree or disagree with that position.
Yes, I agree with that position, and all I was suggesting is saying, but the support has to come federally. But I would do whatever I can as a state legislature to advance exactly what you're talking about.
Money is not speech, in other words.
Right.
You agree with that?
I agree with that. Money has a corrupting influence on speech, and I think it needs to be curtailed.
John and Rush, John, you're on with Senator Ted O'Brien.
Hi, Mr. O'Brien.
Hi.
Hi. My question, I'd like to make a statement and then let you respond. Are you a lock and step Democrat? And I say that in regards to the SAFE Act. You came out and said that you supported the Second Amendment. And then when the SAFE Act was passed in what I consider an inappropriate way, it was rushed through without any debate, it seemed you rubber stamped it. Do you agree with the whole, with the SAFE Act and in its entirety? I'll listen to your comment.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thanks for the call. You know, for me, it wasn't a Democrat or Republican issue. I think our top priority as state legislators is the protection of families and children. And I supported gun legislation that I still support to this day. And I was the only senator in this region to support it. But let's talk about what this gun legislation does. It requires background checks that will keep the most dangerous weapons away from people with violent criminal convictions or serious mental illnesses. It requires that possession of a gun at a school would be a felony. It outlaws internet sale of assault weapons and face-to-face purchase of ammunition. all common sense legislations. It requires reporting of a theft of a gun. Shouldn't it be reported? It establishes a mental health reporting system. And just this week, the state issued a report where there's 34,500 people who have been determined by their counselors and confirmed by their counties whose mental illness is so dangerous they should not have a gun. That's keeping guns away from 34,500 people who shouldn't have them, as reported by their own counselors. So every time we keep the guns out of the hands of somebody who shouldn't have them is a good thing. Look, I go to the Adirondacks every year with some of my friends, and we shoot. We set up cans, and we shoot. Nothing in this legislation is going to prevent me from continuing to do that. But I think the kinds of things that the SAFE Act does are important. Things like making use of a gun in a crime, a felony. Requiring safe storage of guns. I mean, really, if you're a legitimate gun owner, but in your home is someone who shouldn't have access to a gun, either because of prior felony conviction or domestic abuse or mental health issues, you've got to, as that legitimate gun owner, keep it locked up. Keep that storage done safely. So there's a whole range of things that are actually quite good. And I think, you know, it's in terms of the Second Amendment and the most conservative judge on the Supreme Court has held that the Second Amendment doesn't mean that states can't impose reasonable restrictions on gun ownership. That's what we've done, completely consistent with the constitutional requirements of the Second Amendment, and that's been confirmed by the federal district court judge in our area, Judge Scretany, who I thought wrote a great opinion. And he said, you know what? The state has a legitimate interest in protecting the health and safety of its people. The SAFE Act accomplishes that goal. That was the constitutional review. He went on to say that, you know, the one element of the SAFE Act that I think needs amendment, in my view, is you can have a magazine capacity up to 10, but you can only put 7 bullets in it. To me, we don't need to go there because to me, that seems kind of silly and demeans the rest of what is really good legislation. So is it a perfect bill? No, but I think it's a good bill and overall is protecting New Yorkers. Just finally, with respect to the question about how it was pushed through, don't blame me and the Democratic Conference for how it was pushed through, because that was completely what we were going to vote on, when we were going to vote on it, and how that was pushed through was completely controlled by the majority party. I got up the morning of that vote not knowing we were going to vote on it and did my very best to analyze complex legislation and ultimately concluded and still stand by this day that it was sound, sensible legislation.
Should there have been more public comment, more time for public comment?
I believe there should have been. I think it should have been opened to public scrutiny because that's how democracy works best. And okay. I would have supported that. We didn't need to vote on it that night, except the Republicans insisted on it.
Apart from magazine capacity, anything in that bill that you'd like to see thrown out?
You know, if you really want to get into the real weeds, there's a few things about that I think some of the state troopers have brought to me about, you know, what happens if you have a gun that should be registered, if you have an assault weapon and it requires registration of it. It's not confiscation, it's registration. And if it's required, and then and you don't register it, and a law enforcement agency finds that you have that gun, they don't confiscate it. They give you a 30-day notice. And I think at the end of that 30-day notice, it should be clear that, look, it register it and you'll get your gun back. But if it's found that you don't have, if you haven't registered even that 30 days, they're going to take the gun away, but you should get it back when you pay your fine or whatever it is.
Got a couple minutes left with Senator Ted O'Brien. When it comes to an issue that always lights up our phones, I'll give you an example. Howie Hawkins, who is the Green Party candidate for governor, said on this program last week that the cost of health care remains a huge burden, even with the Affordable Care Act, and it's time for states to follow Vermont's lead and move towards single payer, which he said is not going, he thinks that will actually save money and improve access. Agree or disagree?
Well, I think that that's, to a certain extent, at a higher pay grade than I've been elevated to so far. The president of the country has determined how he wants to go forward in providing access to health care to 50 million Americans who previously didn't have access to health care. And I think it behooves us to do everything we can to make the implementation of Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act go as well as we can. And I think that may be a step towards further down the road, maybe continue to refine. But right now, we've got to make this work. And people are entitled in the greatest country on earth to have access to affordable health care. And that's true for every American, not just some.
Do you get the sense that people a year ago with the rough rollout made assumptions that a year later are not holding up, that the Affordable Care Act is performing. We've seen Ezra Klein, a longtime reporter for the Washington Post, now with Vox.com, put up a headline last week. Affordable Care Act is working. Do you think it is?
I think that's true. And I'm proud of this state because we've done particularly well with our health care exchanges. But again, I'm struck by the fact that because this was federal legislation, the governor, thankfully, was able to implement the health care exchanges by executive order because we couldn't pass it in the Senate because Obamacare was so toxic. And I think that's just crazy. But we did get it done. It's performing very well here in New York. People are signing up and people are saving money. I think by and large, it's working.
Senator Ted O'Brien is running for re-election. We've invited his opponent, Rich Funke, on this program and have been working for a number of months now to find time, and we hope that we will. It's an open invitation, and we expect that will happen soon. Senator O'Brien, thank you for being back here, and we appreciate your time and for listening to our questions and the questions from listeners as well.
Evan, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here. I hope you have me back again.
You got it. Ted O'Brien, Senator, running for re-election on November 4th, the Democrat running against Republican Rich Funke. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to Dave Campo, our engineer today. And just a brief reminder, I know you heard Randy Gorbin earlier talk about being in a pledge drive, but look, the host can tell you as well, I love coming to work every day. I even love working with Dave Campo, the engineer, and he can't believe I'm saying it, but it is true. And it requires the help and the support of our public. And if you value programs like this one, we hope that you will go to WXXI.org and help us end this pledge drive successfully. You're listening to member-supported public radio, and we'll see you on a Thursday.